Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Welcome to this LSE event on a cold and slightly windy Monday. My name is Robert Faulkner. I'm a professor of international relations here at the LSE, and I'll be chairing this event, which is running as part of the LSE Festival 2024, which comes with the title Power in Politics. And if you're interested in further events, there'll be daily events running all the way till Saturday. Gives me enormous pleasure to welcome our speaker and discussant today, who will reflect on the political economy that's needed to find an effective answer to the global climate crisis. Our speaker today is Kim Stanley Robinson. As you all know, he's a world-famous American science fiction writer. He's the author of well over 20 books, many of them international bestsellers, including, of course, the famous Mars trilogy. His work has been translated into 28 languages and won him many book awards. In 2016, an asteroid was named after him, Kim Robinson. I checked online this morning to see if that asteroid follows him around the world. Apparently not, so I think we are safe today. In 2020, he published, this is the title of our event, The Ministry for the Future, a hefty, gripping narrative of what the world would be like if it entered into a quite devastating climate crisis many years from now. It covers all aspects of the climate crisis, from technology to the economy, from science to ecology, and it includes politics at all levels, including the United Nations. And I don't think I've ever read a piece of fiction that has so many references to COP meetings, so I was particularly pleased to have read that. Unsurprisingly, given his long-standing interest in ecological issues, he was invited by the UK government and the United Nations to the COP26 meeting in Glasgow as a featured speaker. So I'll invite Stan just a moment to address the audience, but shortly after that, he will be followed by our discussant, Professor Elizabeth Robinson, who is the director of the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment here at LSE. She's an environmental economist. She's worked for over two decades on pressing issues, particularly in poorer countries. She works at the nexus of climate change and health, and she's particularly interested in understanding what it takes to make societies livable and sustainable. And so we couldn't have hoped for a better discussant to the talk that you're about to hear. So Stan will speak for about 20 minutes. After that, Elizabeth will engage him in a short Q&A session, and after that I'll open it up to everyone in the room. And I should also welcome our audience online that's joining us from around the world. I will also take questions from the online audience, so please do put them in the chat or whichever instrument we're using. The social media hashtag is hashtag LSE Festival, if you're likely to use that. Otherwise, please do switch off your phones or put them on silent. But please, without much further ado, join me in welcoming our speakers.
Thank you, Robert, and thank you, Elizabeth, and everybody at the London School of Economics and Political Science for inviting me. It's a pleasure to speak to this institution in particular. So, we are in a carbon dioxide overshoot that will last for the rest of the century. So those of you who are young here, it will be a constant in your lives. There's too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We put it up there at enormous speed on by geological scales. And for us to stay within safe planetary boundaries, as we've learned to speak of them by way of Johan Rockström and Will Steffen, it would be safest by far for human civilization and for our fellow creatures on the planet to pull down about a trillion tons of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. a very, very difficult process that will take decades and will cost a lot of money. The mechanical machines that people are building to do this are hoping, they were hoping, to bring it down for $100 per ton. And now that is looking a little aspirational given inflation and the technical difficulties involved. And besides which, the industrial base and the amount of sheer machinery that would be required to do that is quite astounding. And so really we're going to be using natural means, which is to say reforestation, regenerative agriculture, which would be particularly fine if we could make that work, and that as we're growing food we need, we are also drawing carbon down into the soil that grows the food. The actual people in agricultural departments are looking a little alarmed at the possibility of that idea, but it isn't an impossible idea either, so it's very promising. There are other natural means, kelp beds in the ocean, various kinds of carbon drawdown interventions that would be on purpose. And so the decarbonization is going to be long. It's necessary to do it because of this planetary boundaries. And the numbers get thrown around, but since we're at LSE, I'll throw around some more just to show you how strange they are. The Financial Times recently stated that it would take $30 trillion to make the transition to a clean economy. The Bloomberg Green in that same week estimated it would take $220 trillion to clean up our economy. And I'm not sure they were talking about carbon dioxide drawdown when they did that. But in any case, if you were just to take $100 per ton as aspirational and correct, and then you have the necessity of a trillion tons to be brought down, I leave it to you, thank God, to do the math on this. And it's so fun to be speaking at LSE where I can leave the numbers to you as an exercise later on. Another problem to bring up in our time, I'm going to call it the problem of the petrostates. So first, the carbon overshoot. Second, the petrostates. There are quite a many countries on this planet. 75% of the fossil fuel in the ground is owned by national governments. So although the private companies like Exxon and Shell are dangerously irresponsible, they are not the major part of the problem. There are nation states that rely on selling fossil fuels that will then be burned in order to fund their governments, including police, schools, airports, roads, and also their militaries. But my point is this: their ability to stay functional, not bankrupt, not a failed state, rests sometimes 60 to 70% of their income rests on the selling and burning of fossil fuels. These same nations have signed off on the Paris Agreement. There's not a nation on that list that didn't sign a Paris Agreement saying we will get rid of fossil fuels, we will hold the temperature to 1.5 degrees rise, average global temperature. And so all of those petrostates are under a double bind. They have signed their own bankruptcy, their own death warrant as a functioning government, and there are enough failed states on the planet right now to give us an indication what could happen in terms of social breakdown and failure if these countries were indeed to be pressured enough to go bankrupt. There will therefore be forces in every one of these governments fighting to sell fossil fuels in disregard of their Paris Treaty Agreement. Paris Agreement signage will be flouted, and there will be fire sales of fossil fuels whilst it might still be possible to regard it as something other than poison, which in some senses it is. There will be fire sales to sell it no matter what the treaty agreements say, because international treaties are like marriage vows. Okay, great, you've promised, but you can get a divorce or you can cheat. So these promises that the nations make to each other are promises only. There is no sheriff. And when these promises get broken, there will be maybe excuses, there will maybe be bald-faced defiance. But it isn't like we are going to be able to stop many a nation state from doing what it has to keep from going bankrupt and to keep paying its government and its workers and its people. So since we're here at LSE, let's be a little quantitative. This is a metaphorically quantitative, I have to say, which is something that I like to do. We can burn about 500 billion more tons of carbon into the atmosphere before we break the 2 degrees C limit, which really is a planetary boundary that will be quite devastating. There has been identified about 3,500 billion tons of fossil fuels in the ground. And again, most of this under the control of nation state governments. It's, again, simple. We need to keep about 3,000 billion tons of carbon in the ground. And so if you take the current price for oil as the benchmark for how much that might be worth, and this is completely notional and hypothetical just to pick a number out of the air, but it does exist as a number, you could say that it's the value of what we have to leave in the ground is like $1,600 trillion. Please check my math. My wife is a mathematician and checked my math, but that was a few years ago. It's a game to play as an exercise to the reader, to the listener, to make these calculations and realize, well, 1,600, that's actually $1.6 quadrillion. Does that sound like more or does that sound like less? I don't know. They're both bad enough that the petrostates are not filled with criminals, not in their citizens, and oftentimes not even in their governments. I mean, it's generally regarded these national resources as a curse, and immediately the corruption at the top in these governments is such that they become kleptoparasites, the kind of creatures that eat their own children. And so there are kleptopetrostates, and yet there are also virtuous petrostates. And I proposed this to my colleague Mark Robinson down in Italy last week, and he just laughed. That's an oxymoron, that's a contradiction in terms, et cetera. And I'm thinking, well, no, we have to make distinctions here because there are nations that are saying, look, we need help getting out of this. Colombia, when Petra and Marquez were elected, said we don't want to burn any more coal. They're the fifth biggest coal producer on the planet. And they said, we need help from the rest of the international community to help us on this. And that help did not come. And things are getting fraught and less hopeful and devolving into various kinds of problematic situations in Colombia. And it certainly doesn't help at all that there was no offer of help from the international community for keeping it in the ground. Compensating the petrostates and requiring them to become virtuous petrostates to qualify for that compensation is a project that is probably necessary, under-theorized, under-discussed, and here we are at LSEPS, London School of Economics and Political Science. I was so relieved to see that on the door. It saved me from making a redundant recommendation as the climax of my talk, which is a great improvement in my talk. It already is a school of political science, and that's really what we're going to have to talk about here. The compensation would have to be discounted. They'd have to take a haircut. It's poison now, and that's too much money, a quadrillion dollars. So they discounted. It'd have to be amortized over time like any other payout. Take them a couple centuries to burn that stuff. They could get paid out on a regular basis over a couple centuries. And then also it would need to be entailed. That is to say, they'd have to sign a kind of clean money act. And there are now instruments being arranged by NGOs, by diplomatic groups and governments, ways to try to good governance groups and a group. One thing that I don't even know what it stands for, the EITI, essentially trying to get part of the dotted line to sign on to include good governments and clean money. And so the entailment would be on sovereignty itself. And there, I think everybody in the world, every nation state, every government is going to have to agree. We are on the same planet together, and national sovereignty, as good, as bad as it has been, as much as it has been the rule of law since Westphalia, et cetera, we are now all member states. And in just last week, I could have said, well, the European Union is a perfect example of nation states turning into member states and then coping with that. Reduced sovereignty in the case, in the cause of a larger good. And that shift is psychological as well as financial and political and legal. The shift from nation state to member state has to happen, even to the big countries, United States, China, the EU itself, and of course, mighty England, the Great Britain. Member statehood is part of this process. So, how are we going to finance this much money? Because even discounted and amortized, it's still a stupendous amount of money. Where are we going to get it when every nation state right now in the COP meetings and elsewhere acts so stingy, so miserly? We're just around the corner from the old curiosity shop, so Dickensian in the miserliness of people who are playing with money that isn't even their own and yet acting as if it will kill them to give away a dime to a developing country. So we have mechanisms. We have the COP agreement that everybody signed off, the Paris Agreement, that developed nations will lead, will help developing nations, and those coffers have stayed empty. And the amounts that have been given out are pittances, sometimes less than the sewage budget for New York City to the entire developing world, and then often as loans rather than as, what would you call it? Well, the IMF now calls it special drawing rights. I love this, because it's opaque, and it's meant to be opaque. What are special drawing rights? They're loans that you don't have to pay back. Ooh, what would that be? What does that mean? Well, it's a special, and you draw, and you have the right to it. So I believe the IMF invented that name in order to keep certain figures in the political world from understanding what it is. And about $500 billion have been dispersed to developing countries that are in financial distress. Now, partly this keeps them from going into debt to the IMF. Partly it helps them out in larger causes to keep their governments going. And it is a mechanism. And so is the loss and damage fund from the COP agreement itself, from the Paris Agreement. The loss and damage would be a way that we could begin to compensate the petrostates and do the clean transition in the developing world. And so that, of course, this brings up the question of what is money? And no one wants to go down that rabbit hole. You go from Dickens to Lewis Carroll at that point. What is money? The more you think about it, the more frightening it is, because it's somewhat of a mass hallucination. I know that in economics one, they would say, well, it's a medium of exchange, it's a storage of value, and it's a sign of social trust. And that last one is completely like the Holy Ghost. It's a very difficult concept to get your head around. But people do trust money. And this is strange, but it's working. And if that were to fall apart, that would be a social breakdown of the first order. But can you make money up from scratch? Well, yes, you can. Fiat money. Governments do it all the time. Central banks do it. So putting aside the silly libertarian fantasy of money as private contracts, in other words, Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, as games, scams, delusions, and a fringe thinking. And going back to fiat money, which everybody relies on as much as they do the rocks under their feet, fiat money is also made up. And we saw quantitative easing. We saw it in 2008. When some $5 to $15 trillion made up in order to keep the stupid banks afloat and keep the economy liquid, giving the same gambler fools that got us into trouble money to get them out of trouble, while private citizens once again footed the bill. This is a point that is made often now, that success is privatized and failure is socialized. And this is one aspect of the neoliberal moment that has to change. But in any case, money can be made up. Quantitative easing, and it could be carbon quantitative easing. In other words, its first payouts would be for green transition causes, for green causes of all kinds, and then you would have it disperse into the economy as just regular old money and have the multiplier effect as Keynes described. So carbon quantitative easing is a real thing. It's not a real thing yet, but it could be, and it's being discussed at the level of the Network for Greening the Financial System, which is a think tank organization of central banks. The central banks themselves have gathered a study group to discuss, and the name tells the story, the Network for Greening the Financial System. So money is no longer a level playing field or just a neutral thing, which it never was, but you don't even pretend anymore. You spend it politically on green work, and then it becomes money in the ordinary sense. I recommend to you The Politics of Money by Stephen Eich, The Ascendancy of Finance by Joseph Vogt, The Governing by Debt by Maurizio Lazzarato, a very dark vision, but illuminating as well. Giovanni Arrighi's work, The Long 20th Century, and others. There is, in other words, a description of money within a larger context of a description of political economy. And this is why I love it that this school here has the larger name that I didn't even know it had, that political science is included here. When you split economics away from politics, you have vastly weakened both, and you have disguised the real nature of our social reality. Economics is intimately is a political creature made by people, the economic system that you're in, the political economy that you're in, and then economics is a tool to analyze it, but there's also politics, the making of the laws that create the economic system that you are within. And none of this is natural, and when economics confines itself to the quantitative analysis of the laws that exist right now, with the hope of making them, of optimizing them, making them more effective, more efficient, the words are thrown about, that is a delimitation of what economics could do that weakens it as a force for good in human life. Economics is necessary, but it's always embedded, like the market is embedded, in a larger political and social vision that needs to be remembered, or else the economics becomes purely instrumentalizing and frivolous, fooling around. When you have enough pretenses, you pretend that this is normal, the world that we live in now. You pretend that inequality is natural. You pretend until the pretenses add up to a very pretentious system. And what we mean by pretentious is you're pretending things that aren't real. So there's ways in which economics can become so much stronger by admitting that it's always political economy. And I say this with some force, and I'm coming near the end, as a utopian science fiction writer trying to write positive futures, for the last 40 years, I look to economics for help, and I don't find it. I do somewhat, but I have complaints, and so I'll make my complaint at my exhortation. Steady state economics, behavioral economics, environmental economics, modern monetary theory, the various kinds of, I'll name degrowth without immediately renouncing it as an idea or a useful concept. Because we need growth of goodness, of sophistication, of greenness. And to say degrowth is to lay a heavy curse on a quarter of the human population that needs to have water and toilets. So that's not a good term, but all these attempts to say that economics is a little larger than neoclassical and neoliberal economics in particular are valuable in and of themselves. But the bigger you go, especially in this moment of crisis, the better off the whole world would be, because this is a useful tool and this is a power spot. Economics has a somewhat of a false priest-like status in the world at large and amongst political class who aren't quantitative and don't know what they're talking about, and turn to economists as if they're turning to somebody who knows something. And that is important and useful and needs to be used to its ultimate. So I'll leave you with a couple images, being a writer and an English major. Geometry has theorems and axioms. And what's interesting is, I think in our world of political economy, when there's some people who famously said there is no alternative 45 years ago, then that's saying the axioms are set, like physical constants in the rules of nature. And then you do your theorems infinitely, and that's economics set on certain axioms. The axioms themselves need to be reconsidered, and then the theorems come. Now, think about this as a further example. Euclidean geometry had its axioms, and then in the 18th century, a couple of mathematicians said, well, let's play a game here. Let's say parallel lines meet. Well, how do you do that? Well, they meet at the line at infinity. What's that? Well, we call it the line at infinity. The parallel lines always meet. Let's play the math games. Let's do the theorems from these changed axioms. 200 years later, Einstein is thinking, why does Mercury go faster than it ought to? We've got it wired, the calculus, the physics involved, and yet it's precessing unnaturally. And suddenly he remembered the non-Euclidean geometry of Riemann, and he said, aha, this is a curved space-time. This is not Euclidean space-time. This is not Newtonian grid of space, and then time is a strange thing passing through it. It's a continuum. And the non-Euclidean mathematics of Riemann actually helped Einstein to see that the world itself was non-Euclidean, and that was a model. So, neoliberal capitalism is a model, a set of axioms, and it's terrible at certain things, just terrible, and we've seen it. We've seen 45 years of increasing inequality and increasing biosphere destruction that makes perfect sense if you're just going for the highest rate of return. If you're just going for profit and shareholder value, it's like a bad algorithm. It's like axioms from hell. It's as if the system were ChatGPT-3 coming up with something plausible but stupid. And that's what we've been living in. And now it's wrecking the planet to the point that it's endangering us in radical ways. And the way out is a rather bold political economy. But I want to end with this, because here we are. It's really just Keynes coming back into the room, John Maynard Keynes. Government's in an emergency. Keynes says, anything we have to do, we can afford to do. And that is a very important thing to remember, and he has a lot of good things to say to us. I know in such a dire situation, it's a little bit underwhelming to bring up Keynesianism, but that's another one of the things that is coming along. That's what modern monetary is. Modern monetary theory is neo-Keynesian thinking. The return of government as the driver, in the driver's seat, forcing the economy to do what's necessary by way of law, regulation, and persuasion of the public. And with that, I will end. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Stan. I should add, as a political scientist, of course, I warmly welcome your challenge you laid down to the economists. I might add that you stand in the noble tradition here. We've had other visitors who did the same. Shortly after the financial crisis, when this building was opened, the late Queen Elizabeth came to open the building, and this was just after the financial crash, and she said, if you have so many smart economists, why didn't see anyone this coming? And so you now stand in that line of tradition of challenging our economies. However, not all economists need to be challenged, because we have plenty that are working on these issues. Elizabeth, of course, directs the Grantham Research Institute, where exactly those questions you've raised are being addressed. Who better than to start the conversation, Elizabeth?
Well, I feel like I have to make a confession to start with and say, my name is Liz Robinson, and I'm an economist. You know, maybe this is day one of, you know, not being one, I don't know. But, so much to think about. And I think it's interesting you invoked Keynes right at the end of your talk. And I was thinking, you know, if you haven't read all of Stan's books, please try and read as many as possible. They are awesome.
Oh, that's a good idea. Very good idea.
Very good idea. But you know, I think that when we've chatted earlier, you did describe yourself sort of eco-socialist from the 70s. And you do, in your books, kind of invoke Keynes and this idea of the problem of the power of the few over the many. And you know, reading your books, one feels... And by the way, in the books, the world's populations failed... It's not really a spoiler, but the world's populations fail time and time again, don't they, to tackle climate change. And we don't really have until 2140, we don't have until 2312, so let's bear that in mind. But you sort of, I get this sense that you're always saying to us, we need this sort of different approach to power and society, we need an alternative to present-day capitalism. maybe present-day economics, and yet we've got, and you also talk quite a lot about revolutions in your books. We've got 26 years, you know, we don't have until the 2300. So how do we accelerate change? And I sort of ask this, recognizing that at the moment it's the poor who are most harmed by climate change, and in the future the poor are definitely going to be most harmed by climate change. But if we move too fast, we sort of create friction, just like in physics. And if we move too fast, if we're not careful, the poor are going to be most harmed by our efforts to tackle climate change. So you know, I'm just asking you the very first simple question. You know, where's our roadmap to, we've got 26 years at best, and according to the scientists in the last few days, probably not even 26 years, to really get on top of, you know, like you say, drawing down the emissions, just reducing our emissions to start with. And if we start saying we're going to compensate petrostates, I think a lot of low-income countries have been asking for years and years for a pretty modest loss and damage fund are going to sort of say, no, hang on, join your place in the queue and it should be behind us. So lots of things.
Yeah, I will try to address all of them. I want to say first that I don't think the labels, like, okay, I was trained as a Marxist literary critic, and eco-socialism, what does it mean? I would like to take off the 20th century and 19th century labels and talk about specific policies and actions that could be taken right now. I will say that it's okay to identify the system we're in, which is neoliberal capitalism. It's proven itself incapable of coping with what gets called the polycrisis. And so we need something else, something better than neoliberal capitalism, with its emphasis on market forces as being the driver and the best deciders of what humans do. Nobody wants to buy a trillion tons of carbon dioxide. It's useless. And so this is like cleaning up sewage. It's as if we didn't build a sewage system and now we have a trillion tons of shit that we need to clean up in order to have a decent life. It's as simple as that. And the market does not handle that. The market treats many things as externalities. Social reproduction, in other words, the work people do to take care of each other for free, environmental costs, poisons put into the environment, like this one, CO2. These are all treated as externalities when they aren't, and now the shit has hit the fan, and we're coping with it. And so it can't be the system that we're in, but to name it with earlier names is maybe unuseful, because we can't have a revolution. It's too violent. It's too unconstrained. There are too many backlashes. Not everybody would agree to it. And so what's a revolution except for scientific revolution, or what Raymond Williams called the long march through the institutions? And it speaks to this matter of speed that you bring up. To reform as fast as you can for many years, at the end of it, that will look revolutionary. But it's as Robert Meister, a political economist at UC Santa Cruz, said, we could get the benefits of a revolution without the catastrophe of a revolution by trying to treat every one of the solutions as individual new problem sets to get us to solve certain problems that we have. So I've actually tried to be specific about a few of the fixes that could be done within the current legal system. So, of course, there should be Thomas Piketty's progressive taxation, not just on individual income, but on individual wealth, also on corporate income, also on corporate assets. Progressive taxation, the bigger you are, the more you make, the more you pay. This would be an equalizer and would tend to balance the books for those who are nervous about making money up out of scratch, et cetera. It would be a balancer. So, of course, but taxation, is that revolutionary? Hell no. It was gigantic in the 1950s, and the revolution has been a counter-revolution to claw it back. So there are rather straightforward legal mechanisms that could be part of a political program that is in a left liberal program. It would be maybe the Labor Party could actually have a platform here. That would be good. And it would include planks like this, specific suggestions that don't need to have 19th century labels on them. They just are things we need to do. I'm just trying to be practical. And the last thing I would say here is we have more than 26 years. Those of you who are 25 years, you'll be happy to know this. It's a case of better or worse. It's a case of how much will we push past certain planetary boundaries that we then cannot claw back from, even if every person on Earth decides to claw back. These are the tipping points into runaway to a hothouse Earth. We don't know how close we are to those tipping points. That's the honest truth. The scientists are shocked by what's happened recently. They're trying to explain it, the heating up of the last couple of years, but it could be El Nino. It could be that we cleaned the air of aerosols by cleaning up diesel fuel in ships and by China shutting down a lot of coal plants. The air gets cleaner, suddenly the Earth gets warmer. We had been accidentally geoengineering in a way that cooled the planet by junking up the atmosphere. So all of our solutions are going to be complicated and cut both ways. The first thing to give up is on any idea of simplicity or of purity. It's not going to be simple or pure. It's going to be a matter of ongoing tune-ups and negotiations and a constant wicked political battle to gather 51% to steamroll what opposition there ever comes up to this necessary work. The fossil fuel industry will go down fighting. That's foolish of them. It's bad for their own children and descendants, but people tend to believe what supports them economically. So there's a kind of basic underlying perception that you see happening in the world over and over again. The cognitive map that you build is torqued by the amount of money you have in the bank and how much you expect to. So, but we have more than 26 years. It's just going to be better or worse 26 years from now. And the better it is, the easier it's going to be to continue to make it better. So it now is decisive and important. But apocalyptic thinking, like, oh my God, in 26 years, if we haven't solved this problem, the world just blows up like a balloon, that's not the right way to think of it.
For sure. I think it's a sort of talismanic date, at least, you know, that in terms of reaching net zero. I was thinking when you come to talk, we have history departments. Wouldn't it be nice to have future departments? And then we could have science fiction writers coming and teaching in those departments.
No,
I think
we've don't do that.
We've got an asymmetry somewhere. If we look in the very near future, in the UK we've got an election coming where we may get a new government. And in the US there's what some may think of as rather troubling election, whatever the outcome, actually, it's probably going to be troubling. But, you know, what would you like to see, you know, whether it's us here at the LSE, whether it's sort of our politicians either side of the pond, you know, what could we really be focusing on in the really immediate term?
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ ask social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Holding to promises we've already made and to things that have already begun, the clean transition can actually be done in ways that help people by giving them jobs. If done properly, it's almost a full employment program, and full employment is another troubling thought for ordinary capitalist economics. What would it mean if the government was the employer of last resort and everybody had a job? And then would it become everybody's obliged to have a job, et cetera, et cetera? But full employment is generally regarded as a deal breaker for capitalism, who wants wage pressure, which is to say fear amongst the poor, to keep wages down and keep profits up. So full employment isn't even a goal of our society, and yet that means that there are millions of people immiserated, and the average lifetime of a homeless person is 5 years, because they're in the process of dying the moment they lose their home, and it takes them 5 years of struggle to take them down on average, and I've seen that myself. So there are so many things that could be done that were already being done. The British government was quite good on climate until just recently, and the Labour Party was quite good on what it promised in terms of climate until recently. So this might be election fears or bad polling or just a general sense of the moment is too big to approach directly. In the United States, it's even worse, but I don't know how worse. We won't know till November. It seems to me that some of the fear of Trump is trumped up in order to sell more newspapers and that if you have some faith in the ordinary American small businessman, Republican Christian, you can think probably Biden will win in November. And then some very good stuff has been done by the Biden administration in environmental terms, in climate terms. Essentially, Biden is not Biden. He's not an 80-year-old man making decisions. He's an 80-year-old man who's hired about 5,000 young people who are, it's a matter of personification. We call him Biden. It's actually a team. You could say the White House. It's the same kind of personification, metonymy, synecdoche. Don't get fooled by that. It's the way we turn this into a soap opera of personalities, as if those actual leaders' personalities matter. This is a category error and a kind of soap opera mistake that we make, that all media likes us to make because it sells more advertising. If you just hold the line and cross your fingers and campaign like hell, you need that. And of course, we have the bizarreness of the Electoral College. I was going to say you need that 51%. In fact, you need it very well distributed, 51%, to make sure that it works. And that's too bad, but it's not insuperable. So really, there are so many. One thing I don't emphasize enough is there is a lot of momentum towards the good, including out of the business community, including out of private enterprises who are convinced that the green transition is an opportunity to make a living as a new business, and that it doesn't matter if governments generate the initial payment. That would be like national defense industry. That would be like the space industry. The government pays for certain things that private businesses then execute and make their livings and even make a profit. This is maybe an old leftist thing, but I don't like profit. I like making a living, not making a profit. I don't like shareholder value. These are creepy to me and a sign of a feudal aristocracy that's still alive amongst us. So, but to bring it to a close, there are the momentum for the good and the danger of things going wrong in the biosphere or politically are in a really tight race with each other. And in a tight race, you don't freak out and declare that it's over and we've already lost in advance. That just isn't what you do in a tight race. You have to run like hell. And we are in a very tight race, but ever since I went to Glasgow in November of 2021 for COP26, from a year before that till now, I've been getting an education in what's going on right now. My book, Ministry for the Future, was way off the cutting edge in all kinds of ways. I didn't know. No single person can know. But if the world spends 4 years educating you as to what's going on now, you end up knowing more than you did 4 years before. And I can say this, a whole hell of a lot is going on that's quite good in government, in business, in academia. And so with all these things going on, the fear factor, oh my God, things are falling apart, it's somewhat appropriate and it's somewhat distracting from the sense that post-pandemic world society is actually responding rather well to a world planetary crisis. It looks messy and there's a lot of squawking, but many good things are happening.
It's interesting. I know we've run out of time, so I'm going to hand over.
Question.
So there's no. I won't even ask a question. I'll just make a little comment because I know. So get ready for your questions. It's your turn now. But I was going to, but I won't because I've had the answer about whether you're optimistic or pessimistic. And I think depending on which side of the bed one gets out of in the morning, can sometimes determine for many of us whether we're optimistic or pessimistic. I think there's a pessimism in a way for me, which is that climate change. And actually, Bob Ward sitting there, who sort of pointed out that this in this letter just today, that climate change never seems to get to the top of the agenda for politicians, that many of us care about and want to see something happen. And it doesn't seem to be, like you said, the Labour Party has sort of stepped back a bit, the Conservative Party stepped back a bit. They're the ones who gave us, the first commitment to net zero. So it's I'm glad to hear the sense of optimism and positiveness. More. Hopefully in a more optimistic time frame than in your books, like I said, where we do see sort of catastrophe after catastrophe, but humankind in the end does sort of figure it out eventually. But I will move across now, Robert, for you to find some questions.
Wonderful.
For the audiences.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Okay, I'm going to take a round of questions. I'll start in the room, we'll then go to the Zoom room,
and hopefully I can squeeze in a second round in just a moment. Okay, I've got a lot of hands. Where are the microphones? Can I just see? Okay. Right, we'll start over there. Come round.
Hello.
Could you also say who you are and introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Dinkar. I'm visiting from across the pond. Had a question for you on sort of what young people are doing. So if you look at the brightest people who are graduating universities, they're getting degrees in computer science or business and going into very different professions than trying to solve climate change. So if you look at the top, whatever, 20% graduates from all universities, or even top 50% graduates from all universities, they're not focusing on climate change problem solving as their degree or as their first job. So if mankind is to come together and solve this problem, which is colossal, but the talent is not going in that direction, how, like, you know, we're setting ourselves back every time a new cadre of graduates don't really focus on this. So curious to get your thoughts on that.
Great, thank you for that. We'll stay up there. Any hands up there? Yes, please. Just two rows up to the left.
Hi, I'm Leonie. I'm a current LSC master's student. Since you're a science fiction writer, I had to ask, do you think democratic institutions will survive current technological changes as well as the reduction of national sovereignty that might be necessary to achieve these changes?
Great question. Thank you. And I'll take one more. If you could go over there. We'll come back later to the side of the room in the next round.
Thank you so much. My name is Andre Bautista, master's student in local economic development here at LSE. My question is which are the main strategies for you for the developing petrol countries and developed petrol countries? Do you think that is the same, the strategies, for example, to develop countries such as US, Europe, and, for example, what happened with other regions, for example, Africa or Latin America, when there are many, many needs, for example, education, poverty, and other rights. So how we can develop different strategies for different regions. Thank you.
Great, good. Shall we start with these three questions?
Sure. So young people are getting degrees in all kinds of fields, and it's discouraging in the United States to see the premier universities, many of their graduates, like up to a quarter, going into finance on Wall Street. It looks bad, and I think it is bad. This is a subject for a different time, the ascendancy of finance, which is a kind of a late stage. If you take the Arrighi model of growing economies that hit a certain limit and then get replaced by another one, maybe this is just Marx. At the late stage, you have money turning to money or manipulating money in order to make money rather than making productive goods and value. I'm sure it's a topic in your classes. But the larger point is this. No matter what your major is, no matter what you're studying, it will have some relevance to climate change. And that will be all the sciences, engineering, and then the humanities, and the social sciences and the arts. Because we're in the carbon overshoot, there will be relevant and important things to do in whatever field you feel is right for you. So the only thing I would worry about is people going into finance thinking that they'll be the Wolf of Wall Street, which is really a story out of the 1980s and is like attempting to become a zombie in a zombie economy. So that's bad and they should be talked out of that, but that's just one small part of a larger cohort of young people who know they're in it for the rest of their lives and therefore are ready to do some kind of work on the, and it's a very broad front. Just put your shoulder to the wheel where you feel most competent. Push. But democracy surviving is a very interesting and frightening question. And I would like to shift it to adequate and satisfactory political representation. Do you feel that you have good political representation? And so that will fold China into the model. And you can begin to talk about something that's worldwide that without beginning to make distinctions as to styles of government. The ordinary Chinese citizen will report a better feeling for their own political representation than the ordinary American citizen. You can say, oh, bad polling, brainwashing, blah, blah. In fact, I think it's true that one's sense of political representation is not the same thing as going down to vote when you know the people you are voting for are already bought by an oligarchy and are going to ignore what you voted them in to do. So democracy per se can quickly be bought, corrupted, and turned into a false front over an oligarchy. One could argue that's already happened. So good political representation is what we would hope to survive. And that, I think, is just daily struggle of being a citizen, of getting out there, of doing the things that young people do, of doing more than voting, of being a citizen that talks, demonstrates, takes action, that kind of thing. And it's such a lively time, and everybody on this planet knows what's going on. Even illiterate people have their smartphones, and there are still illiterate people on this planet, just like people without toilets, but they've got their phones, they know what's going on. In a world where everybody knows everything, which is somewhat the situation that we're in, there's a groundswell push for justice. Maybe that's going to last no matter the current battles. And petrostates, rich and poor, that's also a super interesting question of can you, the rich petrostates, some of them got rich early on and are sitting on really gigantic endowments, and they can either make their own citizens even more luxurious than they were before, or they can begin to distribute out to the developing petrostates to keep it in the ground, and the oil industries, even in the national states, can do geothermal. It's the same tech that gets heat out of the earth rather than oil. They can do, they can shift into wind power. The oil industries in particular can shift. And then this is something I didn't mention in my talk, and believe me, it brings up a whole new topic. We need to drill through the ice in Antarctica and suck the water out from the bottom of the big glaciers in Antarctica in order to keep that ice on the land so it doesn't slide into the sea. If those big glaciers slide into the sea, we would be underwater right in this room, for sure. So the oil industry has the tech to do useful stuff. And if they get paid and they don't become redundant, then we have technology transition from something poisonous to something quite useful. That would need to be paid for, but it could be paid for, and then the developing nations could leapfrog the development stage of dirty tech and go straight from almost nothing to clean. And that's the obvious goal there.
Great. Let me now take one or two questions from the Zoom room, yes? And I'll come to you in a moment.
We have the questions from the Laura Moulton Uli, from Member of Society. So it's a question to the Kim. How would Kim respond to presenter's introduction stating novel deficit, what could happen in the distant future? How can society, including our audience, change this climate delism? The second question is about when describing your book to friends to start a discussion about climate change. So what should I say to them about the science that you based your book on? Thank you.
Okay, so very much about what we can do as individuals. Let's take two more questions. Put you four rows up.
Thank you very much. My name is Dermot Barnes. I'm a head of sustainability at an alternative London University. I just wanted to ask a little bit about the right kind of growth that you speak of. I'm sort of deeply concerned with the idea, the incompatibility of kind of infinite, unbridled consumerism and how we balance that in a way which allows economic growth but also represents the planet as a citizen and looks to the future rather than to the present. That's it. Yeah,
great. And the gentleman behind, just one more.
Hi, thanks. Frederick Levy. I've got probably along the lines of competing technologies. So in order to decarbonize our internal combustion engines cars, we have to use batteries. Batteries is finite lithium. With also our data centers, so the IEA reports that 1.5% of all global electricity was dedicated to data centers. So we've got effectively two competing technologies. How do we balance that with climate change?
Yikes, folks. These are hard questions.
It's called the LSE.
Yeah, and I will make a quick attempt. So we only, to the first sim question, the far future is a story space, like Middle Earth or the galaxy. If we get through the polycrisis of this century, it's an unusually dangerous century, and humanity has gone from crisis to crisis. I'm not saying that we haven't weathered crises before. We have. So the present is always unprecedented, but this present is more unprecedented than ever before, because never before could you crash the planet's biosphere the way we can now. So the far future is just a space to think about. There are a lot of human beings, and it's a fun party game, maybe another LSE game, to calculate how many humans will exist if we don't go extinct by killing ourselves off in the next couple few thousand years, and we last pass that choke point into a healthy, balanced society. How many humans does that mean before we speciate into some post-human evolution? It's a big number. It's worth thinking about, and that's the only value of the far future, is the weight of all the people to come that rests on what we do in these decades. That's some pressure. And then what do you say to climate deniers? You say to them, I've tried this, and it rocks them back a little bit. When you're sick, you run to a doctor. So when your life is on the line and when you're scared for your life, you run to a scientist and beg them to help you. And that scientist sometimes will help you, and sometimes they'll just say, sorry, can't help you, and you'll die. But when you're scared for your life, you run to a scientist. And so all the bullshit about denial and doubting scientists, blah, 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 it's all the same science. Extends from medicine right up to climate science. And if the scientists are saying the planet biosphere is so sick that when it dies, you die too, that should be listened to. And it's a pretty effective message. It's very interesting to think about growth. Can there be too much? It's kind of a first world problem in the most literal sense of the word. Some people need development really bad. I mean, refrigeration is a health aid, not a luxury. But what happens if we get to adequacy for all? Then it's one of the oldest Anglo-Saxons. This is an English proverb from this island. Enough is as good as a feast. And I say enough is better than a feast, because a feast makes you sick and enough doesn't. But these were hungry people who made that saying. And in fact, Charles Lamb wandered England and wrote it down, and one of the first times it was written down was by our Charles Lamb, great writer and critic. And he also added a note, there is not a person within 10 miles of this village that believes in this saying. So okay, it's not a capitalist saying, but enough is as good as a feast. And I'm thinking young people, there's a great phrase of people spending money they don't have in order to buy things that they don't want, in order to impress people who don't care. I mean, what's going on? It's a ridiculous trap of consumerism. And of course, advertising wants that badly. They want you to be worried about the elections, because then that's more advertising and then more stuff bought. It has to be resisted by way of a philosophy, by way of an ethical position or an existential position, where you are saying there is no meaning in this universe. Every person makes their own meaning by way of the project that they choose for themselves. You make meaning. Why would I fall for somebody else's meaning that is so evidently stupid? And you just got to try to promulgate that message to everybody. And also, it's kind of bizarre, but this, okay, it takes a lot of lithium, it takes a lot of materials to make a smartphone. Once you've got it, do you need anything else but boots and some clothing? And, you know, aren't you technologically lifted like some awesome god walking the earth? Maybe the urge for more stuff is a kind of an Americanism, really, that of the 20th century that might die out now. And then I think that actually, I think that is the question about energy, new energy sources and all that. It's a good question, because one thing I would love to have the LSE study book on is, does it make sense to build nuclear plants now, or has that been bypassed, and should we be in wind and solar entirely? And I get those contradictory responses, and there are some fans of nuclear power who are so insistent that they're right. I don't know what to think. I'm an English major, but I've got good judgment, but I've never seen the evidence put forth in a way where I can be decided on it one way or another. We have some tens of thousands of nuclear bombs on this planet. They need not to be blown up, okay, or else all of this discussion is over. Each one of those nuclear bombs is enough energy, if plugged into a small nuclear reactor, to run a city for, I don't know, 100 years. And so is it possible to do safe nuclear if it was run by the U.S. Navy, for instance, who have had nuclear subs that people sleep right on top of the reactor for 5 years, their health is as good as anyone's? The waste problem is severe, but we've got places to put waste. In other words, I'm thinking we're in such a carbon crisis, we're in that carbon overshoot, that if we can do necessary energy to lift people out of poverty, we need an awful lot of energy. And AI is a minor part of it, and maybe it'll prove itself so stupid that it won't be the suck that we think it's going to be. But in any case, this is a question for everybody, because I don't have the answer. Is new nuclear, safe nuclear, thorium nuclear, et cetera, a good idea, or has it been bypassed by how cheap and how good solar, wind, water, and battery power have become? A research project.
We'll work on that. We'll send you some reasons on that. I'm afraid we're out of time. I have to say I've not attended as rich and enlightening and encouraging a short one-hour session as this one. We've all been privileged to have taken part in this. Will you please join me in thanking Elizabeth Robinson, Jim Stanley Robinson.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events Podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.